I will definitely say that a lot of times socks don't deliver any real value. It almost feels like a ticket farm. And so the instant response like moments really come in. They get called in from other departments and teams who realize something's wrong and they don't really know what it is.
This video will be sponsored by SNHU. So it's 2025 and cybersecurity is still all the rage. Breaches are at an all-time high and so are cyber salaries. But there's a problem you keep running into. Cyber jobs you want to land are requiring a degree and you don't have one. Let me introduce you to today's sponsor, Southern New Hampshire University, SNHU. SNHU has a flexible online program that also touts one of the lowest tuitions in the country. SNHU is an affordable, accredited, nonprofit university that has dedicated career advisors, webinars, internships, and more to prepare you to enter or advance in the workforce. There's a 32% projected growth of information security analyst roles through 2032, and according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the median security analyst salary in 2023 was $120,000. In SNHU's program, you can learn about these critical subjects: cybersecurity foundations, networking, incident response, risk management, enterprise security, and more. As a cybersecurity professional, these are all important courses. If you would like to know more about SNHU's program, then please visit snhu.edu/textual or click the link below in the description. Welcome back to episode 164 of the Textual Talk Podcast, the unfiltered truth about working in the SOC. I'm your host, HD, and I've been in security for a long time, and joining us today will be none other than Quinlan Varco. Quinlan Varco is the CEO and founder of Blueberry Security, and in just the age of 25, they did so much in cybersecurity. And today they're going to be talking about some of their interesting incident response engagements and some of their SOC transformation projects. For those of you who have heard the term of a SOC as another security help desk and all the great things about SOAR and AI, we're going to pull back the layers of all this and really talk about the truth about working in the SOC and how it can be really fun and show you new things and how it can also be crappy just based on it being a ticket form and organizations really just not having little to no maturity at all in the SOC. So if this is something that interests you, stay tuned. And also, all you have to do is hit the like button. It doesn't cost you a thing to do. Well, let's get on to the show. All right, Quinlan, could you introduce yourself to the listeners or the watchers?
My name's Quinlan Varco. I run a business called Blueberry Security, where I handle incident response and SOC transformation for businesses of all sizes, but really mostly medium to enterprise size clients. The incident response engagements usually focus on things like ransomware or dealing with APT groups or, you know, other forms of compromise.
Great. So a couple of questions when I thought about you saying that is, number one, I believe you're fairly young, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, I just turned 25 like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so how does a 25-year-old create their own company and get clients?
Yeah, so I guess let me start with a bit of my story. When I was 17 or 18, I did an exchange year in Europe. And when I was over there, I wasn't really well accepted among my peers. They didn't really like Americans. And so I ended up hanging out with mostly other immigrants. Some of them were Moroccan, and I became really close friends with them. And they taught me how to speak French, and they also taught me the basics of cybercrime. We did things like, I didn't personally do it, I should say. I learned from them. It was for research purposes. I learned about carding and identity theft, counterfeiting, things like that, and just really got an idea of how the dark web really works. And then when I came back, I turned that into a career in SOC and IR. And I've been doing that literally my entire adult life. I've been doing it for 7 years now, pretty much out of high school. I got lucky when I came back that I immediately found a SOC that was willing to hire me with no experience, degrees, or certifications, and just leveled up from there. My business, though, I started it in November 2022. I really didn't like how SOC teams really operate, especially like in the MSSP space where it's just really ticket farms. And I decided at that point I wanted to do my own thing and really have an impact on these businesses that I work with. I would say that the first few years really was difficult because I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know my product market fit. I just knew the type of work I wanted to do. So I've been trying to become somebody who's well known for these topics. And now my business is mostly focused on channel partnerships, and I really generate revenue through working with other consultants and other people who, like MSPs or other people who have direct end clients.
Nice, nice. So now that we got your background, tell us about some of your experiences, either early on or some cool stuff that you've experienced working in the SOC or doing SOC-related work.
Yeah, so IRs are always fun because you never know what you're going to get. I worked on some really interesting incidents, some of them for like banks or for other larger companies. I've worked for 3 different Fortune 50s during my career, like CVS and T-Mobile and Raytheon, mostly as contractors, but really worked in some interesting environments.
For example, for me, a lot of times my incidents that I work are a Friday afternoon. Like, it's supposed to be quiet where people are getting off work, and then it's always a Friday, and it's something that my specific shift is dealing with. So you're like, you come in to work, sit down, you think it's going to be an easy day, and then you get an email from the Threat Intel team or some other business inside the business about stuff that's happening, and now you got to start a bridge. And now you're getting everybody on calls and trying to figure out what's going on.
I will definitely say that a lot of times SOCs don't deliver any real value. It almost feels like a ticket farm. And so the incident response like moments really come in. They get called in from other departments and teams who realize something's wrong and they don't really know what it is. And so, for example, at one of the banks I worked at, it was just a normal day in the SOC. And then suddenly we get thrown onto a meeting with the mail team and we don't really understand what's going on. And the mail team's basically trying to lead an incident response engagement. They have no idea what they're doing. And they essentially got hundreds of thousands of loan denial, like mail that they had to send out. And this was like extremely abnormal compared to the normal volume. And we had to actually work back based on what they brought to this call and just all of a sudden jump into this engagement where this mail that they were going through, we needed to figure out why were these generated. So we went to the email server to see what caused that spike in activity. And we ended up tracing it back to a loan pre-approval page where you could submit your information for pre-approval. And the threat actors were actually guessing social security numbers by brute force in the last 4 digits. And they had found a way to actually steal social security numbers and take out fraudulent loans under people's names if they had their address and name. So with just their address and name and 9,999 guesses, they could actually steal your social security number and take a loan out under your name. So the way we found that, like I said, was through that other team. And I think this is pretty normal in the industry where we really don't know what's going on. And all of a sudden you're just thrown in this mix with, I'm going to have to figure it out with zero information and almost no logging. And so the way that we were able to trace that back, we had logs of what servers were sending emails. We didn't really know what those emails were, but we had that information from the mail team to signal us what was going on. But on top of that, we could use Gigamon and Wireshark to look at the packet captures from that mail server and actually use Wireshark to reassemble the email. And we found the loan denial, and we had actually found there were like 11 approvals that were sent. So they stole 11 people's information. And it was really exciting because this was a race against the clock. We had to shut down those threat actors before they were able to log in and steal this data. Luckily, the approval emails didn't contain any sensitive information, which was like an extremely near miss. But we were able to actually lock out the threat actors before they ever accessed the loans. And that's, I think, one of those exciting moments where you feel like you're fighting a threat actor. We didn't know the name of the group that did it. We still don't know. And it really wasn't a reportable incident because the threat actor never actually got anything. But it's just one of those moments in a SOC where you go from everything's calm, it's just a noise machine, to suddenly all hands on deck.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's funny enough, I was saying something like this to a team member the other day about how when most people do think about cyber, they do think about all the fun stuff we just talked about. But then when you take a step back, it's like, it's actually important that your security team, especially IR, whoever, understands like how the company makes money in these different ways they make money because of how you just pretty much said a business process was exploited to possibly steal money from customers. Not necessarily the bank itself, even though technically still been stealing, but just understanding that. And then that's when like new detections come out. Because I know for us, I'm still in finance. So we have different detections based on we see certain spikes and things to where we can say, okay, what's going on here? Or someone trying to manipulate the system to get, you know, certain information or trying to do specifically what you were talking about. And once we see that, that's when we reach out to the teams. We have a whole process dedicated just to that, just based on, because if anything's affecting transactions or money, it's at our top priority. And I think it was some good lessons learned from that, especially like you said, they were trying to actually, before I get ahead of myself, you said something that's key that I've seen before too. You have the company, and then of course, sometimes you want to call someone like a client or a customer, like you're the IR team, but yet these different units inside of the company could be considered your customers. There are times when the team that's not the IR team is trying to run their own incident. And you have to come in and say, hey, you guys, let's leave out of this bridge, come join this one. We're going to lead everything from here so we can centralize everything. Because if not, those are the things that you run into. You have everyone talking. There's no order. No one's working on any work streams. And it's a mess. So that was cool that you guys were able to use Wireshark to figure out exactly what was happening. Did that ever happen to them again? Or did they, I guess, I wonder, what did they do to mitigate that process?
Yeah, we were able to mitigate this by removing cookie persistence on the loan pre-approval page and breaking it out into a multi-step process. So you couldn't just spam the form. And then we also set up, at the time, they didn't have a WAF enabled on this webpage. They owned one, it just wasn't set up properly. So we got this web page under that, and then we set up, what's the word, rate limiting, so they couldn't submit more than a certain number of requests per IP. And the threat actor, of course, tried to find ways around that, and I'm sure they're still dealing with it to this day. I don't think that this was unique to this bank. I just think that we were lucky enough to have caught it. I think that this is probably some good threat intelligence for every fintech organization. Is fraud is not necessarily a SOC function, but oftentimes you do need to understand how these are logging data, and when it becomes an incident, how closely are you working with the fraud team. But you brought up a good point about the other departments and stuff. Yeah, the mail team was running this. The mail team, they had absolutely zero technical experience in cybersecurity. They didn't really even know what was going on. But I think it's very normal in across every industry. Other departments have things that they may consider an incident, but it's not a cybersecurity incident. And so they feel that this is urgent, but they don't know why it's urgent, and they don't know to involve us. And I think that happens more often than not, where the business notices something is wrong and they just don't report it. And they don't, because they don't understand.
I agree. And that's why you see, and I don't know when this started. I would have to do some research on this. So what you do see is you have your incident response team, but then you also have, in a lot of companies, an incident management team, where they would be the people that would be handling certain incidents of a certain criticality. And then they may loop the IR team in if they feel like there's some cyber nexus involved with that. So I think that's probably something that a lot of companies have moved for. I know, like, when I was at Goldman Sachs, I was doing incident management there. So they had a specific team just for that, to handle most of their incidents with a small team. But now you're the people, those roles are critical and cool, because you get to interact with a lot of different stakeholders. And the other thing that you said that could be mitigated with these different teams trying to run on incidents is buy-in from the top to say, hey, if there's anything you think is malicious or suspicious, please notify the SOC team.
And oftentimes, like, companies do have these incident management teams, or maybe they've just started to roll them out, and they don't necessarily have the same goals in mind as cyber. And I don't think that they communicate enough at most organizations to share that knowledge or share the things that we're working on. I think I've seen it done in government very well, where one of the rare times that government does it properly and more efficiently than private is they know how to have a centralized team that manages every single performance incident, or like DDoS sort of thing. Like, it's more than just we got hacked. It's everything.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that. Now, to go back to something you said earlier, you said that you feel like a lot of times socks are pretty much ineffective because you feel like they're ticket forming. And I would agree because you do have, let's set the stage. I talked to many different peoples. For one, there is a notion that socks should be fairly easy to get into, which I agree, depending on the company sometimes. If you're literally just working for an MSS and all you do is work for a client and you see the ticket and send it over. Like, you have socks that literally just do that. And then you have some that are a little bit more like, you have like your fusion centers where they have a dedicated client, where they have more trust and they have more leeway to make informed decisions and they're actually doing stuff. And then you have sometimes like maybe like an internal SOC where they can do all these different decisions and they're probably also working with security engineering or all these other different teams to where they really aren't just limited to the scope of looking at the SIM all day. And then you got your MDR, XDR people where they're a little bit more specialized and they come work for like clients for specific things. But I said all that to say is like, why are there, I get it, you do need the model to fit your business needs, but I do not understand for the life of me why, and you mentioned something else too, is about one, I've seen this in different SOC environments. They'll have a tool, like I say, let's talk about the buzzword automation, SOAR. They'll have a SOAR tool that really is not helping anybody, but it's a selling point to say, hey, we got SOAR, but you're not automating anything and your rules are still bad in your SIM. And so you're pretty much duplicating work across two platforms just because you want to have automation that's not automating anything. But what do you feel about all these different like ticketings and how should like SOCs actually be like standardized so people are not just like losing their minds looking at alerts all day?
Yeah, so you said a lot there. So let me start off with the three different models that exist. There's the internal SOC that kind of handles everything internally, which is quite expensive. And there's the Fusion Center model where it's half internal and half with an MSSP. And third, there's a model where you outsource it entirely. And the reason that there's these three different models is price point of what a company can afford. And the other reason so I guess let me drill down into the MSSP issue. These ticket farms that just literally say, okay, we're an auto SOC, give us your security data and we'll pretend we work. They'll say they work on it. Maybe they don't really catch any incidents. At some point, you'll probably realize this and get upset at them and be like, hey, why didn't you guys catch this? We pay you $10,000 a month and you don't fucking do anything. The reason that exists, I think, is because the reason that people buy any cybersecurity products to begin with is compliance. I mean, sure, you could say some people care about not being hacked and there's a business need for it. But I think that the majority of executives don't feel that pressure, like that need to have these services. And when we have regulatory bodies that mandate them, they just want to deploy them in the cheapest, crappiest way possible a lot of times. And as those executives mature and as the companies grow, you may end up with a CISO who actually understands this and understands better models that exist. But down the line, there's so many different people in the leadership chain. That's when there's a breakdown in leadership decisions. And so you'll find that the reason we have these like noise machines and these ticket farms, even at the Fusion Center and internal SOC level, is because these people at the top may have been put into that position from another department, or maybe they have some basic understanding of security, but really they're there to drive the business forward and they don't understand the technical aspects of what we're doing. And so it's a similar problem where they don't know what needs to be tuned, but they know that as a leader, they should be on top of it and they don't want to tune out everything, because if they tune out everything, then they'll get hacked and that person will be responsible. And so with the Fusion Center model or the internal model, that the leader who's making those tuning decisions or the detection engineering team who's saying, no, I don't want to tune this, I don't want to tune anything, they're doing that out of fear of what leadership will think, or if they miss something, what would happen. And I think that's really a mistake, because until we can really get automation in place, until we can really get proper tuning, then the problem is going to remain where eventually we miss something and they do get hacked. And then you be like, why didn't the sock catch this? And it's, we told you we needed to tune all of these things and you didn't do it. Or, and we said we wanted to get SOAR running and we never finished setting it up. And I guess about the topic of SOAR, I think that like organizations will pay millions of dollars for a fancy new tool because ultimately they don't want to fix the problem. They want the problem to go away. And so they think this new tool will fix it. SOAR as a concept is really great. AI is great, right? Like these things, yeah, they could really automate a lot of things. But if we're spending all this time writing playbooks and putting them into production, and those playbooks are too granular and they don't cover enough broad topics, there will always be new types of alerts we need to put in play. And like with threat detection and threat intelligence, like threat intelligence will generate new types of alerts that we need to put in place. And unless those are, we already have a playbook, or unless we already have something broadly automating that, then we need that human interaction to validate those things. And AI can't do everything. And even if it could, we really were put in place to ensure that these computer systems are being accounted for. And that's what the SOC is there to do.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of times, like you said, someone comes from a new department or for compliance, you do see that a lot. Oh, we have to do this cut for compliance. And you're like, okay, but it's not that beneficial. It's not that useful. Like all these companies, a lot of times they have these metrics that they're looking at, but these metrics don't always tell the full story. Sometimes the company think they're doing good off the ability that maybe they didn't attack an attack. So there's, like, oh yeah, we're doing good. Our threats are going down month to month. And so sometimes they think they can reduce staff because we don't have that much volume, whatever. And then they don't realize it's not a, from my experience, these last 8 years, it's not an if, it's a when. It's a when you have an incident, then you realize all the things that you've done wrong. Because, for example, I think one of the most easiest things that I've seen in multiple environments is at some point you're going to see a lot of like unusual authentications or a type of login. Like, I think that's just standard at any environment. And if you get somewhere you don't see that, you're like, are we logging this or what? Because it can't be just we're so good that this is not happening to people that work here. Because that's insane. It happens to everybody. It happens to me even on my personalized Outlook and mail account. So it has to be happening here. And so that's when you start taking a look back and why it is I've said so much over the last couple of years about diversity in cyber, not even sticking to gender, race, whatever, but more so just people from different companies, backgrounds, things that they may be privy to that someone else is. So you bring other people that's worked in different environments that might have seen more. And they say, I don't know if we're doing this the right way. And then to comment on what you're saying with them wanting the problem to go away or also need the human aspect, I agree. I think automation is best suited for those meticulous, mundane, compliancy type of alerts. You get this alert that says you didn't put the right rules on your security group, or this bucket is public, or hey, you just did this to the EC2 instance, or yeah, these are really things that's just letting us know that hey, maybe look into something, but 9 times out of 10, there's a change or something associated to it. Like things like that could be automated to just notify the server owners. And if we don't hear anything after X amount of time, let's investigate. But I don't think technically there are places that have a lot of that tier one stuff automated, and then it just gets to the more advanced things that they want people to do. But every company doesn't have the amount of resources to do that. And I think that's also why I push back so much when people are like, hey, yeah, I was going to eliminate this. And then I was like, yeah, in some cases, but every company is not going to have the resources to do that. It's just really going to be another thing they're going to have to pay for when it comes to logging and ingestion. So they say we might be cheaper, better off just getting a couple of bodies right here instead of just trying to acquiesce to what everyone's doing. Similar to what I've seen some people actually move from in the cloud to going back on-prem. It's like, we'll just keep our own stuff. Like, it was supposed to be cheaper for us, but we'll just go back on-prem.
I actually prefer on-prem, and I really push it hard with my clients. Like, sure, people have cloud shops, but, and for a while, cloud was the next big thing. But I think that ultimately we come down to the question of cost, and is cloud really more secure? And the answer is no, it's not really more secure. And you need to hire experts who can actually handle cloud, which are more expensive. And then also cloud is more expensive by itself. On-prem is just cheaper. really, that's always what I'm pushing to people is we really need to get back to the basics of let's hire really good people who can do this really well, treat them well, and then they'll build a really good system for you, opposed to let's just buy this tool or let's try to get work. And so the different risks that you were talking about, I think are really good points. Like SOC is just one piece to the overall cybersecurity governance and compliance and other ways that you need to secure your environment. And that's why I think incident response is more of my niche personally. SOC transformation is something that I do and I think is really important. But a lot of times these companies can't afford anything until they're breached, and then, or they don't want to spend money on until they're breached, and then they realize this is what I should have done. I need to spend money now. Like 90% of spending comes post-breach.
Yes. It's funny because on this pod, we'll typically be covering different breaches. Like last year, the biggest one was Change Healthcare. Change Healthcare was the biggest one last year. And I was talking about watch, you'll start seeing like all these different postings for either Change or United Healthcare, since United Healthcare bought them, and trying to beef up some stuff. And I talked to CVS last year. They were trying to hire a lot of people. And you know what they said? We don't want to end up like Change Healthcare. Like,
yeah, I worked in the CVS Health SOC, so I can tell you exactly how it is. I don't know if I should be saying it, but I'm going to say it anyways. The problem with CVS Health, and again, this is most SOCs, they were having people complete such a large amount of ticket volume, and a lot of this stuff was just spam and garbage that we didn't need to work through. And people think more is better. If we have more alerts, we'll have better prevention of incidents. And that's not what happened. People got burnt out and then they just started hemorrhaging staff. Something else that was really shitty that they did was they hired like 40 contractors, but they only had 10 full-time positions that were available. And so all these people were like fighting for their promotion or for their chance to actually have a job long-term. And so all these people were overworking themselves, and eventually they hit a wall when they just couldn't do it anymore. Those people got let go, and the 10 people that actually made it, sure, they had the best ticket volume. Maybe they caught some cool incidents, sure. But ultimately, they quit too. They lost all their staff and they had a huge amount of turnover. And this is common. There's so much turnover in this industry.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's so, what I've said for if I'm going into like leadership roles or like consultant type of roles, and I'm talking about, hey, you need a guy like me that would tell the potential customer or client sometimes to push back on them and say, I don't think you should do that because X, Y, Z. Or, hey, why are you trying to go get this shiny new toy when this stuff needs fixed? You'll probably do better with this and hiring like one or two more bodies and spending an exorbitant amount of money on this just for it to sit there. Because I've dealt with that working in the Fusion Center one time. Like we had Phantom, but we were doing nothing with Phantom. And the client was like, we're spending all this money on Phantom, so we need to turn it on. Just for 2 years later, we end up just ditching Phantom and going with XOR. And by that time, we still weren't really doing anything with XOR. And I don't know, this is funny. This is bringing in, I think some people have heard me talk about this before. But so I used to work for Optiv. And let me see, should I say what our client was? Our client was, I could say it, Disney. If they want me to come take it down, they have to come give me a take it down. So we work for Disney. And it was a really big environment. But their big issue was before we got the contract, DXC was their provider and they were horrible. Like all these just one-off different rules. So if you've seen some fire, like that's what it was. So you had all these BS alerts, you had BS documentation, everything in there is bad. So you're just like, when we come to get caught up, like even the funny story about taking over for that contract was that we were set to take that contract over on July 1st, 2018. Prior to July 1st, they waited like probably 7 days before to give us access to what we needed. So they were really trying to, not Disney, but DXC was trying to pretty much sabotage us when it came to starting over. So it was like, three of us working around the clock because it was only three of us that had our access. So we came in like 12 to the SOC and we worked. And I think I worked maybe like 50 or 55 hours that week just because everyone had their access yet. But going through that was like, okay, we got too much stuff going on. Like, all this stuff is not even important. We need to get rid of this and this and this. And then we saw from a measure standpoint and looking at is one of two things are happening. If it's always a false positive, either it doesn't need to be alert or the alert is written in a way that it's not actionable for the analyst and we're missing something. So it's always one of two things when you want to do that. So most of those things we got rid of. Or then sometimes not a false positive, it's like expected activity, but maybe this is something that your team don't understand to where it can actually be a typical malicious threat.
So go ahead. I was going to say what I believe in is threat intelligence driven SOCs. So a lot of times you come into these contracts and they have all of these alerts enabled and you go, why are these enabled? They're not catching anything. And they go, what if they will catch something in the future? We don't know what the alert's on for. And so I really want to push to these people, just turn that shit off. We don't need it. We don't know why it's on. Turn it off. Let's restart. Do you have a threat intelligence program? If you don't, you need to get one. And if you do, is that driving threat detection or do you just have random threat detection? Yes, it should fit into MITRE, but the threat intelligence will tell you what MITRE techniques you need to cover. And if those techniques aren't important to your operation, if they're not what threat actors are doing, if it is not an actual threat vector, then those should be turned off so we can focus on the alerting that matters.
Yeah, and I was about to get to that. Because the one time we dealt with an incident was prior to this, we had these specific bloodhound alerts that had been implemented. And so I'm just seeing them at this time. I'm like the lead of the team. And everybody's pretty much closing with the same notes. So I reach out to my counterparts on the end, like the people that make the alerts. And I was like, hey, I don't think my guys are handling this right. But this was like, we'll get to it when we get to it. I forget what year it was, but this was a combination, I think, of being like a late night shift and maybe a lot of alerts came in. And sometimes we don't talk about in the SOC where other people may not be handling their load. So one person feels overworked. So a slew of alerts were missed. And it wasn't even like they were all critical. It's like some mediums, some lows. And, you know, of course, that's when like, we got a call. We think some data exfil happened. So that's when me and a couple others had to get on and rework the alerts that we found where we figure out where the activity transpired. And I was like, some of these is like, hey, this person didn't even try. I was like, what they closed this out with is not even what's happening here. I don't know what's going on. And so that's when you start figuring out, okay, was it too much going on? Were you just closing it because you just thought nothing was going to happen? What was going on? And then that's the lesson you know when, okay, maybe we need to reassess our alerts. They're not actionable. We got people just doing whatever. And that's why I did QA from a standpoint of not in a help desk way. Like I had QA when I was in help desk where you wanted to make sure you close up the call. It was less than however many minutes, no SLA, yada, yada, yada. But it's more of what fire, what happened, and do your notes make sense? And if they didn't, that's when I would have, okay, a couple of these didn't make sense. So either something you need to study or you may be having a problem with. And then that started helping the team just in general get better because it had some stuff to be actionable on. And we were able to tie their QA scores into, okay, cool, you get your bonus and your cost of living adjustment next year or whatever. I think that's the other part too, is like, how do you motivate your team outside of that, trying to not have them overworked? And one of the things that's not often talked about that other people talk about is people get in the SOC, but the leaders do not have any type of progression plan for them. So it's literally like just there. A lot of times it's not, okay, if you want to go here, do you want to go do threat intel? Do you want to do sec DevOps? Do you want to do detection engineering? Do you want to go do incident response, forensics? What do you want to do? None of those things are ever like centered for someone when they start. So that's why you also see maybe somebody do a year or two and they're out because it's like, okay, where am I going to go from here? No one's asking me what I want to do. I'm still looking at tickets every day and I'm tired of it. I want to do some fun stuff. Like most of these things I'm closing out are false positives. I want to see, and the issue with a lot of people when they do try to go from just regular tier one, maybe we could say 1.5 or tier two, to doing IR is sometimes these companies have the IR team siloed from them and they don't get to see everything that's going on. So they don't get to see from beginning to end how to do things for incident. So a lot of times they get stuck in the SOC just because of they don't have the other necessary experience to actually work in IR, which I think is sucky as well. I really do think IR and SOC, which you see a lot of times more fire teams or like more blended now versus having them siloed to where you just got these people escalating stuff to you. And now you get to have all the fun and chase down the bad guys.
So I think like the silo of the IR team versus the SOC team is first of all, a waste of resources, but more importantly, you're right. It stops people from growing. And I've seen organizations try to combine them and do it ineffectively. And I've also seen organizations who are just happy to keep them separate. I think that the reality is anybody can be an incident commander. You just have to empower them to actually do that properly. The job as an incident handler or incident commander is problem solving. And so most people you're hiring, you hired them because you believe them to be good problem solvers. So if you don't empower your people, if you don't give them training tracks, and you're right, they are going to burn out. And I think like the other thing is people come into the SOC with an expectation of, I want to do pen testing, but I needed to do an entry level job. So I'm going to do this for a year and then I'm just going to go away. And I think that is really a shame because I think that SOC is the first line of defense. And we need to get to a point where it's a respected role and more importantly, like one where people do see enjoyment and career growth. But tier one SOC analysts do just fill in boxes on forms most of the time because the experienced people don't want to do the bitch work. And they're like, okay, tier one, you're going to do that because I don't want to. I think that AI and things like that could replace these roles. SOAR should replace these roles. And instead of throwing bodies at it, we can save, instead of paying them 80,000, whatever, 60 to 80,000 a year for a tier one analyst, we can replace that with AI. And I think we can hire entry-level people into tier two positions because at the end of the day, that work is still pretty simple. You just need to investigate. You need to get these people to think about what they're doing. And I think that a lot of times companies want to replace culture with automated tools, and you just can't. In a security team, you really need to have a very strong culture where people enjoy working there. People want to come in and they want to go and find these threats because that's, if you want somebody to protect you, you need to have them loyal to you.
Yeah, I agree. I also would add, you said something. I'm going to skip past that. Now, I've seen you post sometimes about working with or trying to help those people get experience. From your experience, what have you been seeing from problem areas for people that like hit you up for advice or try to get in?
Yeah, so I think the majority of the time, what I'll do with people is I'll look over their resume and kind of discuss like, why is their job search failing? And a lot of times what it is, they'll pay somebody to make their resume or they'll have something that's almost there, not quite there. I think that if you are entry level on your resume, you need to have projects on there. And if you have IT experience, put that on there. If not, don't put in a summary. Don't put in a bullet list of skills to get past what's the word, ATS. And I also think that because we're doing things now with AI where you can do something like lazyapply.com and just apply to 1,000 jobs in a day with AI. And these recruiters are doing the same thing with AI where everything's automated. If you are a job seeker, you need to get in front of a hiring manager and you need to have a very simple, easy to read resume. One page, projects, experience, that's it. And I'm looking for this type of role, you're just wasting space on your resume. The hiring manager knows what they're hiring for. They don't care what you're looking for. You can either do it or you can't do it. The projects are your only way where you can really differentiate yourself among other job seekers with the same amount of experience. Because if you're saying, and I tell people, just list the project as if it's a work experience. Because if you say, I built a sim, I have a project where I set up Splunk. I know how Splunk works. I know how Splunk query language works. I know how to find things. I've set up a honeypot and I've used Splunk to search for the logs in the honeypot to tell me. And I wrote reports on that. And that is what the job is. And if your projects show that you can do it, then I'm more willing to hire you as an entry-level candidate. So I would say the resume is the biggest thing. And the second part of it is just networking. Like I was saying, you need to get in front of hiring managers. I think people will just send out these like AI LinkedIn messages to hiring managers, if at all, where they're like, hey, do you have a job? I want to work here. And it has all the AI stuff that you can tell it's AI. You can tell it's zero effort. We need genuine human connection because when you are doing sales, and when you're looking for a job, it's very similar. 100 cold calls and 1% of the cold call actually lands a sale or even gets a meeting. that 1% is the most important, but you have to put in so much effort. And that effort needs to be human connection, because people buy because of an emotional reason. They don't buy solely based on logic. So if you are an entry-level job seeker and you want to sell your service, which is your experience or your future experience, to a hiring manager, you have to make that emotional argument. I will be a good analyst because I care about this company, because I care about my job, because I care about this work. And so that's, I think, where a lot of job seekers really fail.
Yeah, I would agree. It's funny enough, I just had a consult with a guy, got a lot of experience actually, and I was looking at his resume. I said, it's really just too much going on. I was telling him, I was like, honestly, on the resumes I do for clients, we don't even have like summaries or objectives on there. It's wasting time. Something else I'll add to when people think they want to do blue team is, I would say, lack of skill and mindset sometimes. And that's because of all the different learning material out there, but none of the material is piecing together. Okay, what's actually going to happen when you sit down and you get your first alert? I know from experience years ago, the first thing I saw, I tried to chase it down, realizing it was nothing. So even just showing people like this, like just because it fires doesn't mean it's automatically bad. Like even just the mindset of that, or me showing them, hey, when you get in an interview, and my goal is to help the tier one person seem like they're tier two, I say things like, hey, I want to first prove that this is actually a true positive or not, versus just going right into whatever you think is happening, because that's like things they're looking for. So if you escalate it to IER, okay, why did you send it to me? What did you do to prove that this is escalation worthy? I think I see those things a lot. And to go back more so on the resume topic is that I tell people all the time, it's people that come to me and they have no experience at all. And I tell them, could I make your resume better right now? Absolutely. But I was like, it would not do anything for you because you don't have any skills yet. I was like, come back to me when you did some projects and you got some skills and some courses. Like I like a lot of people, if they don't have any type of experience, I was like, the only cert I really tell them to get now is blue team level one, just because it's practical. Yeah, because it's practical. And like, you can actually turn those into projects. It's like other things you can do about it. And I've heard people get mad about, it was a guy, my friend sent me a post, and they were mad about people who are in cyber telling people that want to get in, hey, try to brand yourself. And when I tell them brand themselves, I'm not telling them to be an influencer. I'm just saying, hey, like a lot of people reach out to people they don't even know and they want to get referrals. The only problem is a lot of people don't even know who you are. So I showed them, hey, based on me having a brand and people see me talk about things in cyber or incidents or whatever, sometimes I reach out to people who I haven't talked to a lot, but we might be connected. And they're like, oh yeah, I've seen your content before. Like, I think you'd be cool on the team. I'll refer you. That bodes over better than the person who has 5 connections and posted 3 years ago. And so when we're telling you just to get on LinkedIn, like you said, your network, and blog out stuff you're learning. I don't think they understand how much writing will go into the job that they're trying to do, and showcasing how you could convey messages in simple terms to people is a big one. You'll hear of so many different hiring managers or recruiters, whoever you're talking to in the process, and they'll ask about like, how can you talk to directors and C-level people? And so now it's like, check out some of my writing that I did, or check out this video that I did where I was talking about this threat and how you would mitigate it, or how I would mitigate it if I worked for your company. Just by effort alone, a lot of people will be more successful in this field than others. You have the complainers and the changers. I've worked with people who I've never had to check on. They're always working on something. And by the time it's hit month 2 or 3, they've either got an internship or they're doing something where they're close to getting that role, because they're literally putting everything into it and they're soaking up what I'm telling them because they want the desired end goal. And you got the people that'll be complaining about it's so hard out here, which I agree. There are different things. The ghost jobs, there are jobs that get put on pause because of budget or somebody else hired the person right before you're about to get hired. I get all that. Trust me, it is tough. But you do have to find people on the team. I tell people, if you're going to send messages to hiring managers or recruiters, let it be short and concise, to the point. Not, hey, all this stuff. And don't, the first thing you do when you reach out to a recruiter, please don't send them your resume. I always tell them, wait until they ask you for the resume first. Don't just send it to them. They got enough people sending them resumes. See if they're even interested in talking to you based on what you sent them. Because if you already applied, they can go look at your resume and send you an email or something. That, like, That's the other part of the thing that could probably take a whole nother like hour to talk about. But I want to go back on something you said too. You were talking about how soccer rules and it needs to be made into more of a field that's like more respectable. And I agree. I think I've seen that in the industry now. It used to be like SOC, maybe tier one, tier two, but now you have companies that hire like principal levels, or now what they're doing, they're hiring SOC consultants where like they have people like yourself, but they probably just work for another company where they are consulting different clients on what they need in their SOC. Just because most of the time these people have worked in many environments, and outside of just work doing SOC work, they work with engineering, they work with the compliance team, they work with risk, fraud, investigations. They work with all these different teams, so they have solutions to your problem. So I think I do see a little bit more respect put on the SOC name. I've seen where the SOC roles are a little bit harder. Almost 10 years ago, the role was a little bit more simpler. Now it is requiring a little bit more of that advanced skill set and knowing how to do maybe like some scripting or some PowerShell or stuff. So I do see it becoming more than just you're going to look at the sim all day and send this stuff over. Like they're getting people real projects and things to work on. So you can pretty much maybe figure out where your lane may be inside of security. So I think I've seen that trend going upward, and hopefully it gets better. Cause I just used to always hate, like if somebody used to, at first, I would say like years ago and working in the soccer, people just thought all I did was look at the sim all day. So I have an article I did years ago, and I may like either repost it or revisit it or something, but I was like, the SOC is not a security help desk. That was like the big misconception where it's just help desk for security. No, it's not. I work help desk. This is not the same thing.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of different things you talked on. I know we don't have much time left, but the topic that you're talking about with like SOC being like the help desk in a lot of ways, I think that other departments see it this way. Historically, in most companies, it has been treated like this. It's a dumping ground for work that people don't want to do, unfortunately. And I think like the other part of it is tech was in a bubble. Tech became a really big thing during COVID and before that. And it just all of a sudden, everybody wanted tech jobs. And they didn't, and cybersecurity is often seen as a tech job. The reality is, you need tech knowledge, but it's writing. You're right, it's writing. All I do is write. I write content, and my content does well because I'm a great writer. And I'm a great writer because the technical work that I was doing, it required me to become one. I think that you talked on a lot of great points, but I think the most important takeaway from that, I think, is that as we continue to grow as an industry, the people coming into these positions will need to know how to not just be a basic hire. Like, you need to know how to be dynamic and stand out compared to just somebody who says, I want this job, can I do it? Because there's now a shortage of roles. And I know that's not what the news says. And I know that's not what all these cybersecurity influencers are saying. But this is the reality. The reality is it's extremely difficult to get these positions. And people are selling courses online about this is how you're going to make six figures in a tech job. And no, you're not. I made $18 an hour when I started, which was great at the time. And now salaries are going down because there's so much demand. There's a small demand and such a large candidate pool for these positions. And the work that we're doing, you have to think critically in every aspect of what we do.
For sure. I know I had one more thing, because I was going to keep you straight to the 12. Got 9 minutes, I think, till it hits to 10 specific time. I wanted to ask you real quick, did you already name, I guess, the most interesting incident you worked or what?
No, I would say that was not the most interesting one. The one I was talking about at the bank, I think that one's just good talking material. The most interesting one I worked was actually for my own business, Blueberry Security. And I'm very happy that I was involved in this project. Thanks to Doug Brush Cyber for involving me. But we were working for an NGO, very well-known one, owned by a very well-known, I don't know if I should say that, owned by very well-known people. And NGOs are basically, they call them non-government organizations, but they are essentially government organizations in the third world. And what had happened is this company's mission statement was like, stop human trafficking, stop election fraud, clean water, clean energy for all these other countries. And their mission was very, I think, important. And the work that they were doing was important. But unfortunately, at these sorts of organizations, corruption is very normal. And me and Doug came on to this project, and we were tasked with figuring out how they were compromised. normal incident response engagement. But what was very difficult about this one is because they touched on so many different important global issues, they were hacked by multiple APT groups. There was more than one. It was really hard to tell what had actually happened because they didn't have logging. They didn't really have that many reporting requirements. They had Red Canary or some other. They had some software they purchased. They weren't using it. Their IT team was in another country. It was honestly a mess when we came in there. But anyway, this incident was really interesting to me because there was a point where we had found signs of threat actors stealing data on human trafficking so they could continue to do it. And this company's mission statement was to stop human trafficking. Chinese and Russian threat actors had stolen this data so they could continue doing it in these countries. It was horrible to see because it was clear as day. As soon as I got there, it just says the file was called humantrafficking.zip. And it was a Chinese threat actor sending it back to China. I could be wrong at whether or not it's China, but ultimately it was a Chinese IP address and they just didn't have to hide it because there was so little protection in place. They barely had VPNs. They had BYOD. It didn't take me long to look at this and go, okay, they're stealing human trafficking data. This employee is an insider threat. And overall, this organization is very corrupt and overall just not fixing these things that they need to fix. That was super, super exciting to work on. I love the work that I do with Doug because it's always interesting like that. But in the end, we walked away from this organization. We told them, hey, you need to report this. They said, okay, we'll report it. They barely reported it to USAID. And then what happened with this administration, USAID is gone. They don't need to report this anymore. They did report it and that report nowhere to be seen. Nobody cares anymore. And I feel bad for all of these people that it's impacting. I can only imagine how many families are being impacted by human trafficking in that country, which I guess I can say the country, which was Cambodia, which is known for human trafficking. But this didn't impact just Cambodia. This is global issues. And I mean, we had seen election fraud in Cambodia, but we had also seen terrorist issues going on in Burkina Faso. And it was a similar issue where it's the same company. This is the same company. We found this in the same week where all of these issues are really tied to the same parent organization in the US that now has zero regulatory oversight. They have a ton of investors who these executives seem to just be pocketing the money. And it's horrible.
Man, you describing that made me think about you were working an episode of The Night Agent.
It was a very exciting project.
Quinlan, where can the listeners keep up with you at?
So I post most of my content on LinkedIn. I plan to go to other platforms soon, but for now, I just will post LinkedIn content. And you can go to my website, blueberrysecurity.net. And you can email me at quinlan.varco@blueberrysecurity.net if you're interested in working together. I mostly work with partnering with other cybersecurity companies or MSPs to deliver my expertise white labeled under their name or partnered together so we can co-brand our services.
Thank you for that. And guys, hopefully you enjoyed this episode. I actually plan to do, I don't know if I'm gonna make this its own series or whatever, but I feel like we need more just like realistic talks about people that did different things in the industry. But I appreciate you for tuning in or listening today. But until next time, let's stay textual and we're out. Peace.